From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Thailand's caretaker government has reiterated its promise that elections will be held on February 2nd. The statement came after a meeting to discuss an election commission proposal to postpone it. NHK's Pachari Raksawang reports.
With the current wave of Thai anti-government protests in a third day, Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra remains unmoved by calls to postpone next month's general election. Protesters on the so-called shutdown Bangkok campaign are occupying seven key intersections in the busy business district in the heart of Bangkok. They are demanding that Yingluck leave office immediately. The Prime Minister offered to meet with the opposition on Wednesday to discuss an election commission proposal to delay the general election. However, opposition leaders are boycotting the poll entirely and declined to join the discussion. Yingluck said the election will be held on February 2nd as scheduled.
It is our job to hold the election in accordance with the law and the constitution.
The leader of the anti-government demonstrators, Suthep Subban, expressed his opposition.
I don't know who was at the meeting today, but the people don't agree with holding an election under the same rules and the same laws. Such an election would allow vote buying and vote rigging, and it would be impure and unfair.
The protesters surrounded several government offices in a bid to prevent civil servants getting to work. The anti-government side, which draws largely on the country's urban middle class for its support, is insisting that the general election be postponed until political reforms are made. But Yingluck's Pheu Thai party is reportedly ahead in the race to polling day, with especially strong support in rural areas. The shutdown campaign had been relatively peaceful since beginning on Monday. However, police say at least three people were injured in a shooting near the rally site early on Wednesday morning. Elsewhere, no one was hurt in an explosion at the house of former Prime Minister Apisit Weshashiwat, now leader of the largest opposition party. No suspects have been identified.
Regarding the blast that shook the house of a senior Thai opposition leader overnight, as we just heard, no one was hurt, there was no one at home at the time, and the blast destroyed part of the roof of the house. It appears the blast may have been an accident. One police officer said, quote, "It wasn't a bomb. We believe it could have been a big firework," closed quote. Japan's trade ministry said it would approve a revival plan for the utility responsible for the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster, Tokyo Electric Power Co., or TEPCO. The plan hinges on TEPCO restarting its Kashiwazaki Kariwa nuclear power plant to cut fossil fuel costs. An earlier plan by the company outlining a revival after the Fukushima plant was hit by an earthquake and tsunami in 2011 had to be torn up because it could not restart Kashiwazaki. TEPCO also plans to cut costs by reducing fuel spending and forming partnerships with other utilities. We have this report from NHK World.
Japanese leaders have approved a 10-year business plan for the operator of the damaged nuclear plant in Fukushima. Executives at Tokyo Electric Power Company are facing a costly decommissioning process at the facility, and they're counting on restarting reactors elsewhere to boost revenue. Industry Minister Toshimitsu Motegi officially told TEPCO President Naomi Hirose of the business plan's approval. The government has controlled the company since 2012. TEPCO officials want to restart reactors at their Kashiwazaki Kariwa plant in Niigata Prefecture as early as July. They also plan to rebuild aging thermal power plants and find cheaper imported fuel for thermal power generation. They're forecasting an annual profit of more than $950 million that would allow them to gradually lower electricity rates. TEPCO is looking at creating a new division to deal with the growing problem of contaminated water at Fukushima Daiichi and to dismantle reactors. It has set aside $19 billion for the work.
TEPCO should show the people and assure them that the company is changing and it will keep on changing. You should do this through your efforts and action.
The government has increased the limit of its interest-free loans to TEPCO to $86 billion. The utility is using the money for decontamination efforts and to compensate evacuees. Company officials plan to streamline management and close local offices to cut costs by $46 billion. They want to make TEPCO competitive.
Police said three security officers were killed in a shootout with armed militants in the Russian North Caucasus Republic of Dagestan today. This report comes from Itar Tass. The officers were members of a special task force unit. They were reportedly ambushed as they were gathering information about the whereabouts of some militants, according to police. Two of the gunmen were killed in the shootout. One of them was reportedly behind a recent terrorist act in Pyatigorsk, according to the Russian National Anti-Terrorism Committee. From South Sudan, government officials have issued a call for rebel fighters to lay down their arms before it will begin negotiations on prisoner exchanges or other matters. We have this report from Press TV.
Since the beginning of peace talks in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, the government of South Sudan has made it clear that it will not discuss the release of 11 political detainees unless the rebels lay down their arms. The rebels, who are affiliated with the former Vice President Riek Machar, have been demanding the release of those prisoners since the beginning of the conflict. Juba had previously said that the rebels' demand on the issue of prisoners should not be used to influence the progress of the peace talks between the warring factions. However, in what seems to be a turn of events, the government now says that it will agree to discuss the issue of the detainees only after the rebels agree to sign a ceasefire agreement.
We have not dropped it, we have separated the two. We are talking about the cessation of hostilities. Once we finish it, then we'll move to the other topic of the agenda, which is the issue of the detainees.
However, the rebel faction led by former Vice President Riek Machar is looking at the government's move with suspicion. The rebels say that an agreement to end hostilities should also include the issue of the detainees.
There is no clear modalities of how the detainees will be released. So this has become a sticking point in the negotiation. And I really doubt the sincerity of the government, because I think they're using the issue of the detainees in order to stall the negotiations and achieve a military victory.
The chief mediator of the South Sudan talks, Seyoum Mesfin, has just returned from Juba, where for 3 days he consulted with President Salva Kiir on the issue, and the president's stance has reportedly not changed. He wants the 11 political detainees to remain in custody in South Sudan.
The talks to resolve the crisis in South Sudan is lingering on in Addis Ababa, but the number of casualties is on the rise as the government forces and the rebels try to take more land in the world's youngest nation. Colette Anjoy for Press TV in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
As the fighting in South Sudan has now driven more than 400,000 people from their homes and left twice as many in dire need of aid, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon issued a strong statement alleging that both anti- and pro-government forces have been stealing food and vehicles intended for humanitarian relief. The statement said that, quote, the United Nations will continue to actively protect civilians, applying strict impartiality, closed quote. The U.S., which boasts that South Sudan owes its independence to Washington, seems poised to repossess the new nation's sovereignty. With Sudan's uniformed warlords locked in combat, the usual American experts are calling for the U.S. to assume trusteeship of the country, especially its oil. Glenn Ford, executive director at BlackAgendaReport.com, has more.
For decades, the United States and Israel sought to bring about the fracturing of Sudan, which had been geographically the largest nation in Africa. Secession of the South was a special project of Israel, whose most enduring and fundamental foreign policy is to spread chaos and dissension in the Muslim and Arab worlds. Sudan, under the political control of the mostly Muslim North, joined the Arab League immediately upon independence in 1956. Israel has sought to destabilize Sudan ever since, both to strike a blow at Arabized Africans and to curry favor among Christians on the continent. John Garang, who rose to leader of the Sudanese People's Liberation Army, received military training in Israel in 1970 during Sudan's first civil war. However, Garang favored keeping the South in federation with a united Sudan. In 2005, under a comprehensive peace agreement, Garang became vice president of the whole of Sudan and premier of the southern part of the country. He died in a mysterious helicopter crash 6 months later. Garang was succeeded by Salva Kiir, who sports a black cowboy hat that was given to him by President Bush in 2006. Dismembering Sudan became a U.S. obsession under Bill Clinton, who bombed a pharmaceuticals factory in the capital city, Khartoum, in 1998, falsely claiming it was a chemical weapons facility. After 9/11, Sudan moved to the top of President Bush's enemies list. The U.S. and Israel provided arms and training to rebel groups in Darfur, in the west of the Sudan, fueling another front of civil war. President Obama entered the White House the year after AFRICOM, the U.S. Africa Command, came into being, and 2 years before the South Sudanese were to vote in a referendum on whether they wanted to become an independent nation. With much of Africa now under the sway of the U.S. military, Washington dropped all diplomatic pretense and openly bragged that it was the godfather of the South Sudanese state that emerged in July of 2011. What was left of Khartoum's part of Sudan lost most of its oil. China had good reason to be worried, having invested $20 billion in Sudan before it was split and pledged $8 billion more to South Sudan after independence. But now the Americans were strutting around acting like they owned the place. Then came the collapse, as the South Sudanese military broke up into its component warlord parts. Suddenly, the U.S. political class is talking about repossessing the country's sovereignty. In the pages of the New York Times, Princeton Lyman, the former U.S. Special Envoy to South Sudan, calls for the United Nations to assume the role of protector of the country, with oversight of the economy and the oil fields, of course. Another establishment foreign policy expert, G. Pascal Zachary, calls on the United States to assume trusteeship of South Sudan, including control of its military and police. That sounds a lot like Haiti, a country whose independence was stolen by George Bush in 2004, and which remains a protectorate of the United Nations, actually of the United States, France, and Canada, and any corporation that wants to set up a sweatshop. What the American Godfather giveth, he also claims the right to take away. So, what have the South Sudanese won? Certainly not independence. It's just another oil-rich neo-colonial spot on the map of U.S. empire. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
Fighting in Iraq continues with more than 50 people killed in the latest fighting. Press TV reports.
Another bloody day in Iraq. At least 52 people have been killed as bomb attacks rock the cities of Baghdad and Baqubah. Police say in the deadliest incident, a bomb went off in a funeral tent in Shatoub, a village near the northern town of Baqubah. The explosion there left at least 18 people dead. Another 43 people lost their lives and dozens of others were injured when multiple car bombs exploded across the capital, Baghdad. The blast targeted mostly Shia districts. There's no immediate claim of responsibility for the attacks. Extremist groups, mainly Al-Qaeda-affiliated militants, frequently target civilians and security forces in an attempt to undermine confidence in the government and stir sectarian tensions. We're now joined by Middle East expert, Mr. Zayd Al-Issa, who's joining us on the line from London. Mr. Zayd Al-Issa, welcome to the program. I'd like to get your thoughts on the recent rise in violence in Iraq and also who could be benefiting from the bloodshed there.
Well, I mean, there is absolutely no doubt that there is a dramatic surge in deadly violence in Iraq. And what we're witnessing is, again, targeting mainly Shia areas, Shia-dominated areas, whereas the second attack, which happened in a funeral, actually targeted one member of the Sahwa, which is the pro-government Sunni militias. Now, the dramatic surge in violence happening in Iraq is taking place amid a bitter and tense standoff in Fallujah, where we have witnessed that Fallujah have been taken over by the Al-Qaeda, who have been backed up by some tribal leaders who are based in Bakuba, who are based in Fallujah, who are some of the tribal leaders based there, who have formed the military council of Fallujah rebels. They are still hanging on and holding on to Fallujah, although the Iraqi army is surrounding them. But I do believe that they have been emboldened by assurances given by the Prime Minister that there will not be any full-blown all-out assault against the city, and he has asked the citizens of Fallujah to eject or to expel the rebels from Fallujah, which I don't think is actually possible, considering that the police forces are either very weak or are collaborating and actually helping out the insurgents and Al-Qaeda in that city. We mustn't forget that the main beneficiary of those attacks is actually the destabilization and weakening of Iraq, which is one of the main and overarching goals of Saudi Arabia, which perceives the democratic process and the fledgling democracy in Iraq as a major and existential threat. And it comes hot on the heels of the Iraqi government dismantling the protest camps, which the Saudis have thrown their weight and their support for, in order to actually give physical evidence that there is discrimination in Iraq, which is absolutely baseless and groundless, and in order to be seen by the Sunni people in Saudi Arabia, who've actually discovered the patent deceitfulness of their government, that it is the guardian and defender of Sunni Islam. It has been exposed because they see their government backing up tyrannical and dictatorships all around the world. So they want to prove to them, beyond shadow of doubt, that they are still the defenders of Sunni Islam. And it comes also after the dramatic surge of power influence Al-Qaeda, and that is due to the arming, funding, logistical support, and even paying salaries to Wahhabi Salafi insurgents who are represented by Jabhat al-Nusra in Syria and Al-Qaeda in Iraq.
Earlier this week, Liberation Radio's Ernesto Aguilar spoke with Iraq veteran Mike Prisoner about the renewed violence in Iraq, with a look at who's responsible for the conditions which have plunged the country into chaos.
Well, first of all, it's interesting to see a lot of mainstream media outlets trying to paint us as some kind of, foreign fighters, from Al-Qaeda elsewhere in the world coming into Iraq and leading these things, when it's really just a continuation of, what's been happening in Iraq over, since 2003, really. And there's a couple different narratives being put out also by the media about, why this is happening now. And of course, many politicians, including people like John McCain, and are saying that it's because the United States pulled out too soon. And then you have people like Thomas Friedman, who had an article or an op-ed in the New York Times where he made the really disgustingly racist assertion that it's not a power vacuum that was left by the United States that's the result of, this sectarian violence, but that the Iraqi people have a values vacuum, that they need Western values that include, that's really what's behind the violence. And so both of these things we should reject, because they go nowhere near the answer of why this stuff is happening and why there's these, really massive upsurges against the current government in Iraq. And all of these things, 100% of the responsibility is on the United States government, which invaded and occupied the country and intentionally created these divides in a society that was once united.
Now, you have direct experience as a soldier with some of these conflicts, and particularly the U.S. military's awareness of the fact that there were conflicts in the country. Could you share some of your knowledge?
I remember when the interim government was being set up and the politicians were, being selected by the U.S. military and who would be able to run for office and essentially who would win. And they're selected along these sectarian lines. I also remember, being tasked to be interviewing potential Iraqi police officers to be hired into the new Iraqi police forces. And the first question we would have to ask every person applying was if they were Shia, Sunni, or Kurdish. And that was the number one factor in whether or not they would be hired as police in different areas of the country. So these are some kind of just firsthand accounts of, witnessing the intentional divide of the country. But the, politicians now are and some people are kind of, acting surprised that Iraq has entered into this stage. But really, what else was to be expected? I mean, it should have been no question that this would be the outcome. When you have a country go in, the United States invade Iraq, occupy Iraq, dismantle all of its ministries, dismantle all of its vital government agencies, dismantling all ministries except the oil ministry, I would add. And then as a transition, installing a U.S. dictator, Paul Bremer, who said he was in to, build this better system and life will be so much better once we build this new government for the Iraqi people. But what it really did was it dismantled the government, replaced it by a foreign occupation, and then brought into being a client government. And brought that client government into being, favoring Shia and Kurdish elites, not Shia and Kurdish people in general, but the elites from those respective groups. And that propelled forward the conflict. So there's no question that this is what's going to happen. And still today, the president of Iraq, or Maliki, he's who the U.S. put in, he has pursued, since he has been in office, a violently sectarian policy. Where even now the deputy prime minister is in hiding for fear of being captured and executed. And so, from the beginning, this was something that was consciously carried out by the United States because they saw that as the only way, the only chance they had at dominating the country and exerting the colonial type of dominance that they wanted to over Iraq.
I understand, however, that historically this conflict has also been met by efforts to unify against imperialism in the country. Is that true?
Right. I mean, what the U.S. government was very, very scared of is what happened, in the early 1920s when you had Shia clerics going to Sunni mosques and Sunni clerics going to Shia mosques and speaking about the need to be united as Iraqis against the British, against British colonialism. And that is very much what the United States was scared of, is the Iraqi people who had a united, a national identity. Feeding off of that national identity to in a united way fight the United States, and they knew that they had to engage in this policy of dividing and conquering. And this isn't just isolated to Iraq. This is the U.S. strategy in the entire region, where their goal is to shred all pieces of Arab nationalism where they can find it. So all of these countries that had anti-colonial revolutions and became independent, from Iraq to Syria to Libya to Iran, the strategy of the United States and British government is to fan the flames of sectarian conflict when they can, create sectarian conflict when they can, and do what they can to shred the national identity and shred Arab nationalism.
And finally, are there any closing comments you'd like to share with listeners in helping them understand this issue?
People should also remember that this is an unprecedentedly sectarian course in the history of Iraq. Prior to the U.S. invasion in 2003, there was no history of suicide bombings and things like that in the country. But what people should take from this and what is important to reflect on is, there's still this narrative that the whole war began to begin with because, the U.S. politicians were just so appalled by the government of Saddam Hussein and his lack of rights for people and his hold on power, which is a completely ridiculous assertion when you look at the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia or other countries that have far more repressive and dictatorial systems than they can claim Iraq ever had. And so we have to remember that the initial thrust of the war was never had any humanitarian type of goal wasn't about the leader of the country. It was about the independence of the country and the control of the resources. And so as the U.S. government continues to go forward on this policy, I mean, this doesn't exist in a vacuum. I mean, it's part of a larger strategy to create this new Middle East, meaning this area that was this bastion of anti-imperialist and anti-colonial sentiment, turn it back to its colonial-type status. And so whether we're looking at Iraq today or looking at the Syria war, we have to remember that this is the goal of the United States, and they're going to do whatever they can to exploit whatever divisions they can in a society, shredding it as much as they can, destroying it as much as they need to just try to bring under its economic and military control.
A 12-year-old boy opened fire with a shotgun in a Roswell, New Mexico middle school Tuesday, seriously wounding two students before he handed over the gun, according to authorities. The shooting took place in the Barrendo Middle School's gymnasium, where students had gathered before the start of the school day. An 11-year-old boy was in critical condition, and a 12-year-old girl in serious condition. Both underwent surgery for gunshot wounds. As one revelation after another has come out about NSA spying, the mantra from Washington has been more or less the same. The massive spying program has stopped terrorist attacks. But according to a new study, that claim is simply untrue. Journalist Crystal Park spoke with Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, about the report.
Well, we didn't do this study, so I can't take responsibility for it, but it does seem to make sense. I mean, you can see whether or not they actually used information that they gathered through these programs for actually stopping any kind of terrorism. And in fact, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, the Democrats on that committee, said sort of similar things. You had statements a couple of months ago where the senators said that they couldn't find any evidence either that terrorist attacks were actually stopped by intelligence gathered through these bulk collection programs.
Well, the study also shows that a lot of the information that the government was able to obtain to what they say thwart these terrorist attacks could have been collected by more traditional means, whether it was through court orders or some other way of collecting the information besides the bulk phone data.
No, that's right. And I mean, I think it's going to be very rare that the bulk phone data is going to tell them something. The real problem is they don't act on the intelligence that they gather. They had, as you probably know, evidence as to the identity of the Boston Marathon bombers, which was handed to them, and they didn't act on that. In fact, the regional intelligence services, including the Boston police, but also the FBI and the coordinated activity of their intelligence, was directed towards, at that time, towards peace groups like Code Pink and Veterans for Peace. And I think that's what's really the problem here, is that no matter how much intelligence you gather, if the agencies that are in charge are really oriented towards other things, I mean, that's what most of this is really for. You don't need this bulk data to go after terrorists. They need it because they're gathering, they're using it for the reasons they've always gathered intelligence on the U.S. Population for domestic political purposes. You may have seen this last week, there was a lot of front page coverage of the people who broke into the FBI offices back in 1971 and got the files that became the COINTELPRO files. That is, they exposed the FBI as a political police force, which at that time they were. And that's what they were doing then, and there's no reason to believe that they're not using this information the same way. In fact, there's plenty of evidence that they still are.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.